This is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family and Learning Center in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm speaking with Kathleen M. Rogers, military spouse, author, and contributor to an exhibit at the museum. Great person. I met Kathleen at a military writers conference in Albuquerque last summer, and then she and her husband came out to the museum, and we got to be friends. Today we're talking over the phone because she's back home in Texas. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Circe. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, I have been wanting to talk to you about your books for a long time, but before we discuss your books and the latest one that's going to launch on the 2nd of June, let's talk about military family life. Your husband was career Air Force, right?
Yes, he was a fighter pilot for 20 years in the Air Force.
When and how did you meet him?
Oh, my goodness. I was born and raised in Clovis, New Mexico, home of Cannon Air Force Base. Mm. And Tom was flying F-111s at the base. And we met at the officers' club. Oh, dear. so this is a family-friendly, you know, conversation here. Uh-oh. So I won't go into all the nitty-gritty. But we met at the O Club, and we dated on and off for about 2 years. And we married in October 1979 there at the base, at the Cannon Air Force Base Chapel. And I will just say this, the man that played the trumpet at our wedding was Major Roy Westerfield. And Tom and I moved to Tucson, Arizona, where he started flying the A-10 Warthog at Davis-Monthan. And within just a few months, the man that played the trumpet at our wedding was killed in an F-111 back in New Mexico, and that was one of Tom's best friends. So that was my initiation into the glamorous world of being married to a fighter pilot.
Wow. So did you come from a military family since you were there in Clovis, or...?
I'm one of six, third one down. My dad was my dad played the flute and the piccolo in an Air Force band and was stationed at Clovis Air Force Base back before it was Cannon. But my dad had gotten out, did his stint in the Air Force and was out. And so we weren't privy. We weren't, you know, military brat kids really so much. My dad had that, you know, he had served. And so the only time we got to go on the Air Force Base was maybe once a year when there was, you know, an air show and the Thunderbirds would come. Or if I knew base kids as I got a little bit older, I felt privileged when we got to go on base with military families and go swimming at the swimming pool.
Well, did you feel you had a big adjustment then marrying into the military? Was it complicated?
No, because, well, let me explain this. So my parents got divorced when I was a junior in high school, and my mother, my mother had worked as a church secretary, you know, a few years, but what she had to do was go into survival mode, and she got on as a civil service employee, a federal employee, and my mother worked at Cannon Air Force Base, and so we got to go on base, you know, with mom, or stop at the visitor center and sign in back in those days, and it is a strange thing, but I grew up in a military town, and me and my two sisters joked in high school that we were never dating those base apes, and then we all three married Air Force men. So it was an adjustment. The military lifestyle wasn't the adjustment for me so much as the dangerous job my husband did as a fighter pilot. You know, it all looked glamorous and all that, but really the underbelly was that pilots die in peacetime training missions.
So let's just jump into that question then. So what is one of the more difficult moments you had as a military spouse? And then we'll do the flip side. What is one of your best memories? But
okay.
So let's talk difficult.
The serious side of the worst parts, I guess, would be when friends were dying in plane crashes. And as a writer, that I can discuss that a little bit later, but that drove much of my writing and much of my work that I end up selling to publications. One of the strangest things that happened that would be one of my worst memories, if you will, and I got a book out of it in a way, but I wrote a letter to the editor to Air Force Times about officers' wives that married to pilots that were impersonating officers when they would wear their husband's flight suits with the name tags and ranks and go into the base exchange. And I wrote the letter. It was published in Air Force Times. My husband knew about it. And you know what hit the fan? I was paid a visit by the squadron commander's wife, basically slapped on the wrist. My husband was called into the wing commander and was said and was told, "Can't you control your wife?" In other words, can't you muzzle your wife?
Right.
And Cersei, so that negative, I took the negative or weakness, and I turned that into a strength. And that's what drove me to write my first novel.
Wow. I cannot even imagine dressing up in my husband's uniform and going into the exchange. They were actually trying to impersonate, pretend that they were the pilot?
Well, what they would do, these were, you know, colonels' wives, majors, captains, maybe some lieutenants. It doesn't matter. It was officers' wives, and they would go up on these tanker rides. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of a fun thing, a red carpet day. Mm-hmm. Let's bring out the military spouses, and they maybe, you know, could go up in a tanker. I had the opportunity, but I had small children, and I... You know, just because I was married to a pilot didn't mean I wanted to do that. So I never took that advantage. But I could have worn, you know, jeans and bonnet. But some of these gals chose to wear their husband's flight suits. And that's one thing. But when they went in with the rank and the name tag, and what happened is it was a real incident. They were coming in or going out of the base exchange, and a young airman was going in or out and saw these women in flight suits, and the young airman did not know whether to salute them or not because he was confused.
Right.
You know, and that we're talking back in the late 80s.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was driving onto base years ago, and I showed my ID card as a spouse. And all of a sudden, the airman at the base gate saluted me. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
I didn't know what to
do. It was always so strange because...
He was saluting the ID card.
Right. Yeah, he was saluting the rank on the ID card or the stickers on our windshield.
Exactly. And I didn't know what to do because that had never happened to me. And I wasn't sure if I was supposed to salute back or not.
Know.
It was funny. But this was what you were explaining was, you know, an entirely different matter.
Yeah,
interesting. So what is one of the best memories you had as a spouse? Or you can have a couple if you have some.
Some of the best memories, I would say, you know, it sounds so generic, but the close friendships that I established at each of my husband's, every time he got stationed somewhere, and not just friendships on base, because we didn't always live on base. Mm-hmm. Once we had kids, we did, but the close friendships of either civilian neighbors, if we lived off base, or the neighbors on base, and the friendships in the squadrons, and there was something they, you know, when you're moving every few years, those friends become your family, and it really hit me when we got when we moved to Alaska. We were at Eielson Air Force Base outside of Fairbanks, and those memories up there are so cherished because my sons were born there. They were born at the Army Base Hospital in right outside of Fairbanks at Wainwright, and because there wasn't a big enough hospital on the Air Force Base. But it was the friendships. It was the pride, the pride in that my husband was serving his country, and my children were young then. By the time Tom retired, they were 4 and 6 when we moved to Texas, and he started flying for the airlines. But the friendship, the ties that we had, there were special bonds with other military families, and there were 2 years where Tom and I lived at Fort Hood, Texas. That's before we had children.
Mm-hmm.
Tom was an air liaison officer working closely with the Army. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you this, Cersei, those Army wives took me under their wings, and they welcomed me like I was one of them. And I became the mayor of our housing area on post.
Mm-hmm.
Here I was, the little 24-year-old Air Force wife. And it was a great experience. I got to go to these meetings where, like, a 3-star general was leading the meeting, you know?
Mm.
So.
Well, you know, a lot of the spouses do say that their, you know, some of their best memories are the friendships. So how many times did you actually move then? And then where was your favorite place to be stationed?
Okay, so when I married my husband, we left New Mexico and went to Tucson for 3 years. Mm-hmm. I loved it there. We lived off base,
mm-hmm.
Formed many friendships, both in the civilian community and the military. Then we were at Fort Hood for 2 years. Then up to Alaska,
mm-hmm.
where my sons were born, we lived on base.
Mm-hmm.
And then our final assignment was Louisiana. So we went from desert Tucson,
mm-hmm.
to Central Texas,
mm-hmm.
then up to, you know, Alaska, and then down to swampy, humid Louisiana.
Was that Barksdale?
No, we were at England Air Force Base, which is Alexandria, and England Air Force Base closed in December 1992. As a matter of fact, I wrote a big feature story about base and post closures for Air Force, Army, and Navy Times. But I can't really say. I had my I have great memories of each place, and I have some bad memories.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this, Cersei, since I'm a writer, we're talking about writing.
Uh-huh.
What I would say about England Air Force Base is I got a book out of it. My first novel is set at the fictional Beauregard Air Force Base, and that's in central Louisiana, and really, I took some experiences that happened at England Air Force Base, and once we moved to Texas and I had the freedom, and once my husband retired, I had the freedom to write the things I really wanted to write about that I couldn't write in an essay to say Air Force Times.
Right,
so I put those into fiction.
Wow. So I want to talk about your kids for a second, the brats. And I know that you guys got out when they were really young, but then your husband became a pilot, you know, commercially. So I imagine it's the same kind of lifestyle, you know, dad's always going and coming and, you know, under some sort of danger. Did you move a lot once he got out with his job, or did you stay put?
Once Tom retired, we had to move off the base at England Air Force Base, so we moved into town there in Alexandria into a little subdivision called Good Earth, had the best civilian neighbors there, Ruth Foster and her kids. They took us under their wings. Their whole family adopted us. I'm still Facebook friends with a bunch of Ruth's family. She grew up in a huge family right outside where the base was.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tom came here to Texas, went through American Airlines training, and then we followed. And the house that I'm living in now for 28 years, that's where my kids end up mostly growing up. So they both have memories, especially my oldest son that's almost 35. He has very vivid memories of living in Alaska. And he was little. He's one of those who has memories way, way back. And then my youngest son, who's a captain in the Army Reserve now, he has no memories, of course, of Alaska. He was a baby.
Mm-hmm.
He has some memories of Louisiana, but my kids, I will say this for them, I can't really speak for them, but they always knew they were military brats. Even when Tom retired, we still considered them military brats, and that we were still a military family, although Tom retired.
Right.
They grew up proud of their dad's service.
Mm-hmm.
They grew up knowing airplanes, military and civilian, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we would always drive out to what was still then Carswell Air Force Base, and we'd go to the BX. And
mm-hmm.
so we tried to keep them a little bit around that military environment just so they could remember their heritage.
Right. Well, and one joined the military then, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
The youngest went to Texas Tech, graduated from there, and then he enlisted, and so he went to basic training, and then he got a slot to Officers Candidate School and at Fort Benning, and then he was active duty, went to Afghanistan in 2014 as a platoon leader, and then he got out, and then he went back into the reserves.
Well, that seems to be a theme that we hear with military kids. They either join the life or they absolutely turn away from the life. You know, it's like one or the other. Hey, so let's shift gears. You mentioned several books. How many books have you written? And give us a little synopsis, like the title and a synopsis of each one.
Okay, thank you, Cersei. So I've written four to completion to date, three published. My fourth novel will release June 2nd, and that is The Flying Cutterbucks. But the first novel is titled The Final Salute. That's the one set in central Louisiana. The Final Salute portrays a military family's life amidst possible wartime deployment and a scandalous cover-up involving the patriarch of the family as the eyewitness. And my second novel, no relation to the first. The second one is Johnny Come Lately. It deals with the repercussions of a heat-of-the-moment confession, an absent mother, a son's enlistment during wartime, and many other issues that American families deal with day to day. My third novel, I was challenged by a friend who writes haiku, and I thought if I could put a synopsis in a haiku. So, Seven Wings to Glory is, when son goes to war, mom fights racism at home, Texas town wakes up. So that's the synopsis in a haiku. And then The Flying Cutterbucks, which releases again this week. In essence, The Flying Cutterbucks explores the fierce love and loyalty of a family of women over generations. It was pitched as a serving of fried green tomatoes set against the backdrop of presidential elections for the Me Too and She Persists generation. The story centers on a Gold Star family of a fighter pilot missing in action in Vietnam and the women he left behind. It exposes the collateral damage of war, sexual assault, racism, elections, patriarchies, and false patriotism while supplying the satisfaction of action, resistance, and a strong female cast fight against oppression.
Well, so it sounds like I was going to ask you, but I might as well just conclude that even though you're writing fictional novels, you use real life or current events to influence your subjects. Would that be a fair assessment? Wow. So with the military theme and the military families playing an important part in the book, are most of your readers from a military background? I mean, I don't know if you have a way of knowing that or not.
I'm sorry, are most what?
Are most of the dogs outside are going crazy. Are most of your readers from a military background? Do you know?
Oh, thank you for that good question. I would say, especially in novel one, The Final Salute, I would say half or 75% of my readers were definitely military, not just Air Force. I really think I had like 50% male readers, 50% female. And then when I moved on to Johnny Come Lately and Seven Wings to Glory, those are companion books together. I tried to really move on to more what I would consider women's fiction, even though I had my military family still in the stories, fictional military family. I think I lost some of my male readers and maybe some of my military readership. It will be interesting, Cersei, what happens with The Flying Cutterbucks,
right?
The new novel, because it's very much about strong women, and they may be from a military background, the patriarch that's missing in action, but I go straight there with real life issues that we've been dealing with the last few years in this country.
Well, they will be interesting to see. And of course, you know, I wanted to say that, sorry about the dogs, but, you know, we are doing this via phone because you're distance from us, but also because we're in the middle of a pandemic. And watching the news in the last couple of days with the riots and the outrage about, you know, racism in this country, I think that your book is going to be very timely.
Yes, in the Flying Cutter books, the racism I hone in there is racism against Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
And in Seven Wings to Glory, the racism honed in on racism against African Americans. Even though I'm white, I'm not trying to write from a minority viewpoint, mm-hmm. I guess, though, as a woman, if you want to consider, we're still fighting the glass ceiling, but I write about issues that keep me awake at night, Cersei,
mm-hmm.
issues that matter to me,
mm-hmm.
and even though I try to write entertaining stories and page-turners, I hope they're page-turners, you know, I'm not just, even though my books might be issue-driven, I still always keep the story in mind that there, you can't just have a book about issues, a novel. You have to have the story to back it up.
Right, right. So the Flying Cutter books actually is partly set in New Mexico, and so I know you were stationed there and you have family ties. But why did you put it in New Mexico?
Okay, I had briefly mentioned New Mexico in my first novel, although it was set in Louisiana. I had one of my characters who was from New Mexico. Because I was born and raised in Clovis, New Mexico, on the east side, just a few miles from West Texas, I always felt, I can't speak for everyone, but kind of like we were the forgotten side of New Mexico. I think it's changed somewhat, but in a lot of the travel magazines, we were forgotten. It was all about, you know, the central New Mexico, northern New Mexico.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, let's face it, when you're from eastern New Mexico, it's just flat. You know, it's agriculture, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm.
Farmers, cattle, horses, and then, of course, the railroad
mm-hmm.
and the Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the Flying Cutter books, It was my fourth novel, and for me, Cersei, it was, in some ways, it's my love letter
mm-hmm.
to my home state
mm-hmm.
and to the east side. And then I also devote, let's see, three or four chapters take place in Las Vegas, New Mexico, in northern New Mexico. So in the novel, it's Pardon, New Mexico, on the east side, that's my fictional town,
mm-hmm.
and then I drop my fictional characters into real-life setting in Las Vegas, New Mexico.
Well, and you did some research where you actually went to some of the locations where your grandmother had grown up that you didn't really know about, or like...
We always knew. My grandmother was from Iowa, mm-hmm. and when she's gone now, but when she was a young woman, she got on the train. She rode the train to New Mexico, and she worked as a Harvey girl for the Fred Harvey Company mm-hmm. on the Santa Fe Railroad line. And she was a Harvey girl at the Castaneda Hotel in Las Vegas, New Mexico. And then she worked there from 1928 to 1930, and she transferred to Berlin and was a Harvey girl there. And then years later, her younger sister, Nellie, was 9 years younger. Nellie did the same thing, came to New Mexico, and also worked as a Harvey girl. And she started out at the little Harvey house in Vaughan. We grew up, Grandma talked about it.
Mm-hmm. Now,
there weren't as many books out as there are about Harvey girls now and Fred Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandmother died in 1978, and I wished I would have asked more questions back then. But I was young, and I didn't know to ask the questions. But I've always been intrigued. And so in 2017, I was home in New Mexico. I received a Distinguished Graduate Award from Clovis high school from the alumni association there, and so we were home for that awards banquet, and then we planned to go and to see my mother, who lives in Clovis, and we drove up to Las Vegas, and we got a private tour of the historic Castaneda, and also the Montezuma was the Fred Harvey building there, and then we stayed at the Plaza Hotel right there on the historic plaza, and so I had some scenes on the plaza, in the hotel, and at the Castaneda that are in my book. And although, you know, I write contemporary fiction, when I go to a place, if I feel moved and I tap into the energy of these places, and if I'm moved, I picture my characters there interacting. It's almost like I'm living in two different dimensions. There's me, and then there's my story people who have a life of their own.
Well, and Las Vegas is absolutely gorgeous. And when you go, I was up there not too long ago, and I was amazed at how pretty and how many Victorian houses there are up there.
Yes, there's over, I don't have the exact number, but there's over 900 buildings on the registered as historic places. In Las Vegas, New Mexico.
Wow. So going back to writing now, did you always know you were going to be a writer, or that you wanted to write even as a kid?
Well, I declared myself a writer when I was a junior in high school. Now, I didn't really know what that meant, except that I was got on the high school newspaper and was a staff reporter trying to figure out, you know, didn't really know what I was doing, but that's how I learned on the job training. But my first memory of writing something down that felt exciting was an assignment in seventh grade at Gaddis Junior High in Clovis, and we had to write like a you know, little fictional story, and I wrote this, I guess it was a mystery story. It had skeletons in a basement with a trap door.
Ooh, hey.
So I wish I still had it. You know, it was handwritten in cursive on notebook paper. And then in ninth grade, junior high still, I wrote a poem called Free Bird, and it was for English class. And I think I still have that in my file cabinet. There, something sparked between the mystery story in seventh grade and the little poem Free Bird. I felt like I was trying to find my way, and words and images and putting those into words and trying to figure out who I was, that became my way of dealing with life. And then when I was younger, you know, it wasn't writing stories down, but I was a daydreamer. From the time I can remember, always daydreaming about things, you know, wondering what it was like to be someone else. I would sit in rocking chairs. We used to joke in my family that I broke several rocking chairs because I would, when no one else was occupying that rocking chair, I was in that rocking chair, rocking away, daydreaming, humming, singing. And looking back, it was a, you know, maybe self-medication or soothing. But that calming effect, I still love rocking chairs. I have a wicker rocker on my porch in the backyard. I sit out there a lot when the weather permitting and rock and think.
You know, I was thinking when you were giving this explanation, did any of your teachers then encourage you, the teachers that read your skeleton in the basement or your Freebird poem, did they encourage you to be a writer, or did they discourage you?
The first encouragements I really, that set inside me, that set in my chest and fluttered and gave me hope, I don't recall anything about the seventh grade teacher or the ninth grade teacher commenting. It was Mrs. Sharma. I think I had her in English maybe my senior year. In my yearbook, she told me she was impressed, and it took me all these years to really go back, find her inscription in my yearbook and say, oh my God, Mrs. Sharma, wherever you are, if you're still alive, thank you. The other person who really made me believe particularly was Mr. Bielkoff. He was my English teacher my sophomore year at Clovis High. Mm-hmm. And then when I got on the newspaper staff my junior and senior year, he was the newspaper, you know, sponsor. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated high school there my senior year, I received two awards at the local high school banquet, Most Improved Writer and Best Story. And then Mr. Koff had encouraged me, and he helped me submit, or I think he's the one that submitted it. I had written a story about UFO sightings over New Mexico. He submitted it to the New Mexico Presswomen, and I won first place statewide in feature story for a story titled UFOs, Strange Blobs of Light Whiz Through the Night. That got the, ENMU, Mike Slinker was running information services at the time, and that got grabbed his attention, and I received a letter in the mail back in those days, you know, the old snail mail, and they invited me to come down, and they offered me a student position because I'd applied to go to school there.
Right.
And so and it was work study, so I didn't get my paycheck. It helped pay my tuition.
Mm.
But I started writing little student, you know, blurbs, hometown stories, and I also got on-the-job training about photography. So it all was a stepping stone, and then I moved back home, took night classes, and I got hired as a cub reporter for the Clovis News Journal. Now it's called Eastern New Mexico News. I was 19 years old, and I went to this interview, and Bill Southern was the editor at the time, and he said, "I'm sorry, we don't have any openings, but Searcy somehow," and I'm sorry, it was Southard, with a D, Southard, somehow I end up with a story. I started out writing headlines, obits, first birthdays, and within a week he let me write a feature story, and within a few weeks I got to go interview a Thunderbird pilot coming in for the air show at the base, and had a page one story about this fighter pilot. Little did I know then that one day I would marry one.
Wow. So were you working as a reporter then when you met your husband?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that's a good question. I had just found out, I believe the day I met him is the day I found out that I got the job. And then I started like the following week. And I didn't like him when I met him. I was out at the club. I was 19, got in because my mother worked on base. One of those stories. But, you know, he was in his flight suit, a bunch of the pilots walking around in the O Club bar. And I thought he was arrogant, and it turns out, you know, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. It turns out I've been married to him almost 41 years, just a big teddy bear, really. I think the arrogance hid. This is what I discovered, being married to a fighter pilot and having so many friends, is there had to be a certain bit of that, because what they did when they strapped themselves in a jet was, you know, dangerous.
Right, right. So then you had this career, and then you marry your husband, and you have to leave it. So how did you manage that? Did you manage to get a writing job or a newspaper job at the bases, or did you do freelance work? What was your portable career like?
That's such a great question, Searcy. I was, you know, would take classes on and off. You know, it's a community college in Tucson. Then I had a couple of decades before I went back to college. But I started freelancing. So I learned the hard way. So I had the day job as a cub reporter. Then I married my husband. And I started trying to sell my work. And I am definitely, if I say that I'm the queen of rejection, my path to publication, and I'm traditionally published, I know the pain of rejection, because I faced so much rejection early on. But, you know, something within me, I was like a stubborn old mule. I kept reading about other writers back then. This is long before the internet.
Right.
even before the computers, you know, I typed on manual typewriter, wood-burning manual typewriter, I'm joking, but
yeah.
I would always read, like, all it takes is that one yes.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give up. Keep honing your craft. Trust the process. And, Cersei, I started out small.
Mm-hmm.
I started out writing essays. I started out writing, you know, just small things. And step by step, that's my whole writing career.
Yeah.
I didn't like overnight success of, oh, I wrote the great American novel and it just got published. No, it took small things. And I remember living in Alaska. I sold two stories to a magazine called Family Magazine,
mm-hmm.
and they're still around. They're handed out at the commissaries free every other month. As a matter of fact, I now know the editor. She lives in Long Island. Her name's Dina Santarelli. I think she's still the editor. But so I sold these stories in the late 80s when we still lived in Alaska, and I was a young mother, and at the time, they said they had about 500,000 readership. Now, that was all, you know, primarily military families.
Mm.
Oh, my gosh. That was a big deal for me. I sold a story. My little brother had gotten killed in a tragic car wreck. I wrote about that, and that was published in a Christian magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took... The way I got my foot in the door at Air Force Times was that letter to the editor that led to a lot of scuffle. But after that, I submitted an essay and just a small short piece. And you know what, Cersei? After that, they bought everything I submitted to them. I went from writing short essay pieces to getting offered cover stories and op-ed pieces. And that went on about 6 years with them. And then the way I got my foot in the door of Family Circle magazine,
mm-hmm.
that's the big,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yes.
national magazine. I wrote a cover story when Desert Storm, when Iraq invaded Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget being on the phone with the editor up at Military Times, who I'd worked with,
mm-hmm.
and he was giving me the writing assignment. My husband had just deployed
mm-hmm.
and to go over, and they were all going over to Saudi Arabia,
right.
And Tom flew A-10s then, and it's a funny story. My youngest was 3 years old. I was trying to act all professional, and, you know, I was trying to pretend like I was this professional author.
Right.
I didn't want them to see all the crunchy cereal on the floor, you know,
right.
When you've got young children. And I locked myself in the back bathroom, and I sat down and used the top of the closed toilet as the desk, and I was scribbling all the notes on a yellow legal pad while my three-year-old was on the other side of the bathroom door banging on the door.
Yes.
The male editor over the phone said, Kathleen, is everything okay there? And I told him, you know, my son, and he started laughing. He said, I'm a dad. Open the door, let your son in. I mean, my son was, you know, just on the other side of the door, but I was at that time, and
mm-hmm.
as a woman,
mm-hmm.
I think women still go through that today, you know. It's like, I was a young mother,
mm-hmm.
but, and a young military spouse, Cersei, but
right.
you know what I wanted? I wanted to make it as a writer, and that was always my focus. You know, going to Squadron Coffees, that was all great, but there was part of me, and I understand it now, where I never felt like I fit in.
Right.
It didn't matter, you know, whether I looked like the image of the fighter pilot's wife or any of that. I never felt like I was totally one of them. I was always an outsider. Well, I understand what that is now. I'm a writer. I am always and have always been the outsider looking in.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Imagining
what
it's like to be in those other people's lives. And that's where the novelist got created.
Well, and I've read somewhere that, and I believe it because I am a writer, sort of, but a writer will write even if they know that he or she knows that nobody will read it. They are compelled to write. And I understand what you mean. You are a writer, and you're on the outside, and you are looking. And I've been writing journals since I was 12, and I have every one. It's interesting to go back and read. Question. So back then, you were writing, and you had little kids, and so you couldn't have a set routine. But do you have a set routine now? Like, do you get up every morning and write from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m., rain or shine, or do you have a set thing you do?
Not anymore now. You know, I've been writing for decades, and, you know, it's just, it changes with the times. When my children were younger, what I did is their school schedule gave me a built-in discipline, if you will. So when they were at school, let's go all the way back to kindergarten and elementary school. When my kids were in school, I did my, you know, I was a runner then. I would go run, get cleaned up. I was in my home office, and I was working on what the story that grew up to be The Final Salute, and that was a 16-year effort before it ever saw the light of day, but and a hundred rejections on that one. But I kept office hours, if you will, and then at 3 p.m., boom, the second half of my day kicked in of school, kids at home. And then as they got a little bit older, you know, they were more, you know, self-sufficient. I just kind of go with the flow. Now, nowadays, my kids are grown. My husband's retired. You can have too much time on your hands. So I am working on my fifth novel, and I've taken a little bit of a break to help do all the pre-launch stuff for the fourth novel coming out next week. And after I get it launched and give myself time and, you know, and, of course, in the pandemic, I'm not going out doing physical book signings and speaking engagements, but there's thank goodness for the Internet, and there's things we can do, even like our conversation here. But once I'm in a story, this is how I write novels. I worry them into being. I'll wake up at 3 in the morning, and I scribble notes by the bed and go back to sleep and try to make sense of those notes the next day. I don't, like, get up at 6 and come in here every day. It varies, and now that I don't have to, you know, get anybody off to school, I can get up in the morning, have my breakfast, do whatever, walk, whatever I'm going to do, and then it's like that little, it's like a nagging, it nudges you, like, get busy, get writing. Sometimes I'll read for a little bit, but I'm almost driven once I get to a certain way into the novel, a few chapters in, and then I'm like, Katie, bar the door, then look out. Then I become hyper-focused, and then it's all about getting the manuscript finished, and I don't, like, write one draft, two draft. I am a slow wheel moving. I am writing and revising as I go. Sometimes I write out a sequence, and then I puzzle everything together. That's my process. It's messy.
Yeah.
Every writer has to find what works for them. And it's easy for me to say that now because I've had decades to learn this.
Right.
When I was younger, I did try to work on being disciplined and not just writing when I was inspired. If I had waited, my first novel would have never seen the light of day. There were times I used to joke with my husband, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to pretend that I'm a writer, and I'm going to go pretend I'm writing, and I'm going to go have fun, and I'm going to play. And it's like you just have to, you know, mind over matter or whatever. It's whatever you have to do to get yourself and get your words down. And some writers say, oh, I, you know, write so many words a day. I don't do that. But I know what works for me. Now, I don't have 20 novels out there published. Some of my writer friends have 50.
Right.
Every writer has to find where they're, what works for them.
So I know some of our listeners are aspiring writers, and they're wondering, is it necessary to get an agent, or can you just, did you do it on your own, or did you end up getting an agent for your novels? How does that work?
Okay, it's different for everyone, and I'll just say this, Thirsty, nowadays, as opposed to when I was just starting out, nowadays there's so many paths to publication, mm. you know, with digital, with the internet. There's more freedom for writers. Back in the old days, you know, the gatekeepers,
right.
if you didn't have an agent, you couldn't get your work seen by, and I'm talking traditional publishers.
Right.
And for me, I grew up old school because I grew up with the print background and working newspaper, magazine, traditional, you know, they paid me when I wrote and I sold something, I got paid. That was my background, and that's how I wanted to be published as a novelist. That's one of the reasons it took 16 years. When people started self-publishing, or the vanity presses back mm-hmm. in the day where people paid thousands of dollars, and there's still a few around.
Right.
That wasn't the route I chose. Other writers have to find what works for them, but I did, I had one agent, I never formally signed with him, but he kept reading my work and he encouraged me. If I hadn't met him, I might not have finished The Final Salute. I thought it was finished in 3 years, and then I found out I submitted it to him,
mm-hmm.
and he did not sign me on. He rejected it and just said the writing's not there. I spent years trying to figure out how to make my writing come alive. I did get lucky and signed with a Manhattan-based agent within the next year, and he was kind. He started submitting my manuscript,
mm-hmm.
and he submitted it to Bantam Books.
Mm-hmm.
3 weeks later, the rejection letter came from a young editor there. She was kind enough to write me a letter through the agent, mm-hmm. telling me what I needed to do to improve my fiction. And so, Cersei, what I did, I backed off of the dream of getting it published.
Right.
And went into total revision to not only find the real story, but to truly find my voice as a fiction writer, as a novelist. And then when The Final Salute finally got published in 2008, it was Leatherneck Publishing, a small traditional press in Oceanside, California.
Mm-hmm.
I always said all through those years of, you know, they say it just takes that one yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to tell Tom, it's going to take a fighter pilot to get this story, because my main character was a fighter pilot. Cersei, the man who published me, owned Leatherneck Publishing. He had been a Marine fighter pilot in Vietnam.
Ah.
And then he started his own press. And then when I was ready with Johnny Come Lately, when I finished it in 2013, I knew I wanted another agent. My first agent ended up dropping all fiction writers mm-hmm. back in the 90s. We parted on good terms. He was a gentleman. He gave me hope, so I kept working at it. Then with the second novel, I did sign with an agent, and she is the agent who repped Johnny Come Lately and Seven Wings to Glory.
Mm-hmm.
And then I parted ways with that agency, and I signed. I'm now with my third agent, Diane Nine. She's president of Nine Speakers, and she's fabulous. But that's my route. Mm-hmm. I like having an agent. I like having representation. But again, it's very hard to get an agent. It's hard no matter at what level we are as writers. I will say this, if I can, one little piece of advice to aspiring writers, or really any writer that is writing, whether it's memoir or fiction, don't rush to publication. If you're going to self-publish or you're going to start submitting queries, make sure your work, you know, get another pair of eyes on it besides someone who loves you.
Good advice.
What's that?
So that's good advice.
Yes. And it's hard. It's hard sometimes. I've been there. I know. I know what it feels like to get that sting of rejection over and over. I know what it feels like to get that sting of, oh my God, this person says my baby is ugly. And it usually, I've gone to critique groups, I've been in all these different, you know, writing communities, and it always takes me about 24 hours to lick my wounds and then say, you know what, either that other person was right, or, nope, I'm going to reject what they said and go with my gut. You know, it's just, it's an interesting journey being a writer. It's definitely a roller coaster ride, ups and downs.
Yeah. So we've spent almost an hour here, and it's been fascinating, and I've taken away you have to have a thick skin and kind of keep plugging at it. Where can people find out more about you? Do you have a website or an author page or a Facebook page that you can share?
Yes, I've got a website. It's KathleenMRogers.com, and my last name is R-O-D-G-E-R-S. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. I do have a Pinterest account, but I can't quite figure that one out.
Yeah.
But I'm on the internet. So okay. Everybody, you know, I'm easy to find.
And your books are available on all the online platforms, or where do you buy your books?
Yes, on all the online platforms, and if anybody wants to support their local indie bookstores around the country, they can order my books, they can call their bookstore, they can go online. Most of the indie bookstores now, with the pandemic, you know, will ship the books to the front door, or you can do curbside pickup. Another, I want to plug Military Family Books. I think you've associated with them, and they're with Elva Risa Publishing as well. But Military Family Books is now carrying the Flying Cutter books on their online bookstore. And there's also Indie Bound. People can type in Indie Bound and type in the title you're looking for, and you put your zip code in, and it will give you all the local independent stores in your area.
Oh, that's very cool.
And then you can order.
That's very cool. Very cool. So we need to wrap it up now. It's been a wonderful conversation. This could go on all day, but it's been great this morning. And so once again, I wanted to let our listeners know that I have been speaking with Kathleen Rogers about your books, about military life, and it's been a real pleasure. And so I wanted to thank you for joining us, and also to thank our listeners for listening to our podcast, At Ease. I wanted to remind our listeners we have a wide variety of topics we cover on our podcast, and we encourage you to follow us on militaryfamilymuseum.podbean.com. Our podcasts have been made possible through our sponsors, Sandia Area Credit Union, New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, and organizations like Military Brats Registry and Military Brats Seal. So, Kathleen, it has been lovely. Thank you so much for joining us. This was fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me, Cersei.